Thanks everyone for being here so early today. We'll, as Christopher mentioned in his opening, there are some uncertain times, and suitably for that, the topic today is in the storm. So you can interpret that various ways. It could be sanctions, it could be war, it could be trade tariffs. And we have a great panel today from all over the world and all over the shipping industry, so I'm sure we'll get some very varied opinions on what's going on. And if I could get our panel to introduce themselves briefly to you, and we'll get started with the questions.
Good morning, everyone. It's a bit like a tribunal, isn't it? Bit of a weird stage. My name is Martin Kröger. I'm head of the German Ship Owners Association and involved in all sorts of policy making. When it comes to ship owning. And yeah, that's me. Happy to be here with you guys.
Hi, I'm Caroline Young. My day job, I am a CEO of a small tanker company. I'm here representing the International Chamber of Shipping. Thank you.
Hi, good morning, everybody. My name is Mark Church. I'm head of sanctions at North Standard P&I Club and the chair of the IG Sanctions Committee.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Thank you to Capital Link. Thank you to ABS for being a sponsor. I'm Joe Kramick from the World Shipping Council. So we represent the global liner shipping industry, 90% of all global tonnage of container vessels and vehicle carriers. So look forward to the discussion today. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, everyone. All right, so we'll start with a kind of general question and open to anyone on the panel. And how would you see that the uncertainty surrounding kind of trade tariffs, especially the US tariffs, and the general uncertainty around geopolitical issues at the moment is impacting your day-to-day work? What are some of the practical challenges that you're facing as a result? Do you want to start, Joe?
Sure. For the liner industry, we serve the trade, and so shippers are our customers. And shippers are making last-minute decisions on whether to move cargo or not in response to the U.S. Reciprocal tariffs. And those last-minute decisions, while the liner industry can be nimble, they cannot be as nimble as shippers who make a go, no-go decision. So I like to say that, you know, a shipper is kind of like, they can be like a light switch and say, you know, if there's 140% tariff, it's a de facto trade ban. They're not going to move cargo. The liner shipping industry is trying to manage a global network, reposition equipment. And so when they come off a trade lane and then all of a sudden, you know, the tariffs get suspended for 90 days and they have to go back on the trade lane, that is not like a light switch. That takes some adjustment. We're very good at being nimble. I always say trade likes to find a way. It's kind of like a river. And global trade, despite some lower forecasts, continues to go up. But those who can be nimble and agile, as much as possible, there's success to be had. But it is a tremendously challenging operational environment.
Thank you.
Perhaps I can just add to what Joe said. So I think everyone is clear that global shipping requires global rules. We need to have free and open trade so that we can be efficient and cost effective. But with the geopolitics and the tariffs, it creates a lot of uncertainty. And what Joe said is correct. We are nimble. We are flexible. We can adjust our service capacity. We can change our routes, but to a certain extent. So it creates uncertainty, and if it creates uncertainty, then investments will slow down. And if investments slow down, then it is not good for the global trade, and it will not be good for the global shipping.
I think this uncertainty that we are facing, especially in the context of President Trump, who is, I think, one of the biggest disruptions we've seen in the past decades in shipping, just because he takes away that planability and what shipping used to rely on, including financing, including relations to China, including the warlike situations that we have in some sea areas in this world, which are all in one way or the other connected to the United States, or at least to the policy politics that the United States are acting with on the market. So it's really this uncertainty and disruption that we are facing is is quite unheard of. And everybody was prepared when Trump came in. Everybody was like, oh, okay, yeah, we know that guy. We've seen him before. You know, it's his second tour, basically, or it's his second tour of duty. But the reality, how it actually impacted shipping and international geopolitics was something very, very different than it was expected.
And I think we see that in the insurance space in sanctions compliance, where people obviously have different views on the success or otherwise of the sanctions against Russia. And when those sanctions first came in, there was a huge amount of effort that had to be put in to make sure that we were all compliant and we were advising our members and clients on how they needed to be compliant. The one thing that actually made things a little bit easier was you had the UK, the EU, and the US generally speaking with one voice. And that consensus does seem to be breaking down a little bit this year. So lots of people have remarked that this February was the first time that on the anniversary of the invasion of Ukraine, this was the first time that the US didn't introduce new sanctions alongside the EU and the UK. That was a potential sign of divergence. And then, of course, we've had the oil cap being reduced by the EU and the UK, and the US not following suit. So I think added to that, added to the global uncertainty, is the uncertainty as to the direction which Trump and the US is going to travel in relation to sanctions in the coming months.
Thank you, everyone. I will stick with that topic of Trump since you've brought it up. I'm sure that will be interesting to the audience. There's been obviously quite a lot of tension on the sanctions side, but also in relation to the Trump administration position on climate change. And the IMO, on the one hand, is, you know, trying to push climate targets and environmental targets, and the Trump administration is less supportive, shall we say. And I'd like to hear any opinions on that, kind of how that trade is going to play out, in your view.
Perhaps I can share that it is a bit worrying for us. We believe that the IMO global, the carbon pricing mechanism and the global fuel standards, it is the way to go. It is complex, it is difficult, but I think we need to support it as a global maritime industry. And with Trump less supportive, actually we understand that they will attend the IMO MEPC meeting in October. So what are our concerns? Our concerns are that not only that they do not support the measures, they are going to threaten countries with tariffs, with bilateral measures if they support the measures. I think that is actually the concern of the global maritime industry.
And it's all connected, right? It's not only climate change we're talking. It's not only adopting an IMO agreement. It's the Trump administration coming forward with an answer to the question from Europe and other Western states how to increase the sanctions on Russia. And the U.S. states, we are happy to increase the sanctions on Russia, but only if you introduce tariffs on China in the region between 50 and 100%. And by the way, we don't like international agreements at all. So if you are voting pro IMO agreement on mitigating CO2, we will also include that in the negotiations when you ask for sanctions. So it's every single geopolitical topic at the moment is connected, especially by the US administration, with each other, which makes it very, very complicated. And I think that is a very new situation, one we never faced at least not in IMO, because IMO is based on unity and adopting, you know, agreements and international conventions on a unified level, even if you have like tough negotiations in the background and the decision leading to adopting a legal instrument, at least it was always adopted in a unified way in IMO. And that is definitely changing. I mean, in the last 20 years, I haven't seen IMO voting on such an important international agreement as the CO2 mitigation measures are. So this is really something, and it's so hard to predict. I mean, you guys have Arsenio Dominguez later on the panel, I think. So one of the questions I would recommend to pose to him is what his impression is where we are going in IMO. My prediction would be it's difficult to say at the moment. Nobody really has the answer.
First off, I would say the liner shipping industry is fully committed to the IMO net zero framework. We need a global framework to undergird global trade. That's the bottom line. I did an op-ed the other day where we talked about it's maybe more than some want and less than others want, but a lot of time and effort has been put into this solution to take us to realizing the gains from the investment. And the investment from the liner shipping industry alone is conservatively $150 billion in private investment in new tonnage. There's over 200 dual fuel ships on the water. There'll be 800 more by 2030. So the demand signal is there for the new fuels, but you need the framework in place in order to incentivize and offset the cost difference. And without the framework, it's going to be tremendously challenging. And I never thought that, you know, all this would be linked, like Martin points out, that, you know, you would have an administration, you know, coming into the space. But from our view, this is in the hands of member states, and member states like the EU and many others have been longstanding supporters of this framework. So we'll see what happens on the floor at IMO and on October 17th. But we're staying positive. We're staying optimistic. There's some choppy seas ahead to get it across the line.
I think, I mean, these challenges are met by building consensus. And I think that's the real difficulty at the moment, this danger of further fragmentation, whether it's dealing with the issue of climate change or whether it's dealing with the growth of the shadow fleet. You know, these challenges need global responses. And actually, how do you build that consensus and get as many people agreeing on a way forward as possible is very difficult.
Thank you. That actually leads me to sort of follow-up question on that is, with all these various challenges impacting lots of different parts of the industry, what scope is, you know, you mentioned this, Mark, already, but like, what practical scope is there for market participants to cooperate to try to kind of navigate some of these challenges? Have you seen anything around that?
I think, it's really difficult. I think on the sanctions side, you know, most people now are clear what the sanctions are, whether it's against Russia or Iran. They put in place compliance programs, insurers put in place compliance programs, and they know, okay, the bits that they can control, and they deal with that. The problem is, you know, probably the biggest development over the last 18 months in the sanctions space has been the designation of thousands of tankers, or nearly 1,000 tankers. About 15% of the global tanker fleet is now subject to some form of sanctions. And not just tankers, other vessels as well. And these vessels aren't just designated and then dying. You know, about 30%, we reckon, probably stop trading. But the majority of those vessels will continue to trade and will continue to sink. They will continue to collide with other ships. They will continue to have maritime accidents. And that's the wider challenge, in that we can all put in place our compliance programs, but what do you do if you collide with a shadow fleet vessel? What do you do if a shadow or parallel fleet vessel drowns in the English Channel and spills oil? You know, it's almost the easy step is to say, okay, look, we're being strong, we're taking real action here, we're designating lots of ships. But as I say, these ships don't just disappear. So these areas that are much more difficult to control, you know, a compliance program doesn't stop you from having that maritime accident. I think that's where a lot of effort needs to be put in and think about, okay, how do we scrap these ships? How do we make sure that if there is a maritime incident, people are able to respond quickly? How do we make sure that these ships are properly flagged, properly manned, proper safety standards? And I think that's probably a bigger challenge now than, okay, understanding exactly what sanctions apply to me, what I need to do to comply with them.
Yeah, thank you. And actually, staying with you, Mark, for a minute there, how does that kind of environment impact how you might assess risk for an insurer? If somebody comes to you and they say, we're going to be sailing in XYZ place, and you know, you have to take into account that risk that these things might happen. They might have a collision with a shadow fleet vessel. You know, think, well, how are you able to, or how are you, I suppose it's probably not that easy to assess that risk when you're looking at insurance assessments.
It's not. I mean, you know, all the P&I Club's starting point is we want to ensure lawful trade, and so that's our goal. The challenge that we have, I don't think, is probably not so much in pricing the risk, because the risk of colliding with a shadow fleet ship can happen anywhere in the world. The problem that we are increasingly dealing with is where the trade is lawful. But there's an over-compliance attitude from the financial sector, from banks. So maybe you have a ship going into Cuba or Venezuela doing perfectly lawful trade, but then you need a surveyor appointed, you need to get a member of the crew some medical assistance, and you find actually that for perfectly reasonable reasons, banks don't want to touch those payments, and you have problems actually doing that first response. So yes, of course there's a challenge around pricing the risk, but there's also a challenge in actually making sure that we can respond where that trade is lawful. Because if it is lawful, the starting point of any P&I club is we want to be able to respond and deal with any claim. Because we've got I think one of the real debates at the moment is around, okay, should Western shipping be carrying Russian oil to third countries, which is lawful trade? And instinctively, some people might say, well, actually, those ships shouldn't be doing that trade because you're funding Putin's war effort. If you then said, well, if one of those ships grounds through the English Channel, would you like that to be a mainstream good vessel with international group standard P&I cover in able to respond, then you might get a different answer. So there's all those different dynamics in play.
Thank you. Going back slightly to the tariffs element, obviously that's a ever-changing environment. It's a different tariff every day, and different levels, different countries. I'm conscious that we are missing one of our ship owners on the panel, but I'm sure others can contribute to this. Is how have we seen much in terms of adjustment of trading patterns or strategies of ship owners in terms of trying to respond to the tariffs or just trying to avoid having to get tangled up in them altogether? Martin, you might have a view on that.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the tariffs, I mean, the charming part about the tariffs is that they're not hit shipping directly, but indirectly, obviously. Our tariffs are the fees that the US has announced to be introduced in October on Chinese-built ships. That's a tariff in itself, if you want to say. But the classical tariffs, no, they don't impact us directly, but nevertheless, the impact is, of course, there. I mean, when in, I think it was 18 or 19, 2018, 2019, tariffs were introduced on steel and aluminium, transatlantic trade dropped by 20%. So it does have an impact. But obviously you have the choice as an owner or operator to redirect your vessels wherever the trade might move to, because the trade doesn't disappear just because you introduce tariffs. It just moves somewhere else. So it's difficult to say like how negative the impact of the tariffs are actually in the end, because the trade is just going to be on a different trade route. Shipping, but that of course it causes huge operational problems, right? So on the operational side, tariffs are quite a large pain, I would say.
Thank you. Maybe I can add on the ship owner's point of view. So when we have this USTR 301 that's coming into effect in October 14. You can see that there are opportunities, and the opportunities are with the ships that are not Chinese built, nor operated, nor owned. So by the Chinese or the Hong Konger or from Macau. So there are opportunities, and you will see a difference in how the ships are going to be redirected. And there will be companies who will take opportunities to that. And so with the trade tariffs of 10 to 50%, actually many countries are still grappling with the implementation. And you talk also about tariff arbitrage, and the countries are thinking about that, but it is also a dangerous slope to go, because US has made it very clear that the penalties are going to be very stern and very swift. So it is quite an uncertain world. I think even the governments have no idea on the implementation. Even when we talk about the USTR 301 coming into effect on October 14, NX3, NX4 on the vehicle carriers and the LNG vessels, they are saying that it's not within the scope of the USTR 301. And will we see a challenge on that? Many uncertainties. But what I can see in the last 35 years that I've been in shipping is that we are most resilient. And whenever there's a crisis, somehow we seem to thrive. So maybe there are opportunities here. I'm quite certain there are.
And of course, you know, cargo needs to be ready to carry the cost. It's not going to be carried by the ship. It's going to be carried by whoever needs the goods that you carry on your ship. And that is something societies need to ask themselves, you know, are we ready to actually carry the cost that is introduced on us? And the answer is still open, I would say.
Amazing, thank you. And I'm from a sort of more narrow point of view, how do you see that technology, or in particular AI, can help maybe navigate some of these uncertainties? I'm conscious, Joe, that we've had an exchange about AI previously, and just interested to see whether that, what are the kind of ways in which we could harness technology or even AI to help participants to kind of deal with the issues in at hand.
Sure. Yesterday we announced a cargo safety program that is pretty revolutionary. It's going to use AI, machine learning, to screen cargoes. It might be a surprise to some in the audience, not our P&I friends, but every 60 days there's still a fire on board a container ship, and these fires are mostly due to mis- and non-declared goods. And particularly now with the carriage of lithium batteries and electric vehicle batteries, these fires are more and more challenging to put out. And the regulatory scheme is in place, but in the box ship industry, you know, we only know what the shippers tell us that's in the boxes. And so we're hoping we can harness AI to achieve a higher level of safety and reduce risk, and perhaps, you know, eventually that can even translate into, you know, better P&I rates down the way for some members. But most importantly, it translates into safer conditions for seafarers, for shipping, for customers' cargo. And it looks like low-hanging fruit out of the gate to start with, and that there's tremendous upside. So that's one way to harness AI.
I think in the sanction space, AI is becoming increasingly important. It doesn't seem that many years ago when we used to go and see the regulators, and they used to say, "Oh, can you not just track where all your insured ships are at any one time?" And we used to look at them and think, "This is just crazy. How on earth could we have a real time evaluation of what all our ships are doing?" But now, you know, that is obviously very, very, very straightforward. And all the P&I clubs monitoring where their vessels are, getting AI-generated alerts when their vessels are calling high-risk areas or doing STS operations which may be of concern. There's still some way to go, I think, in the cargo space, actually identifying what cargoes vessels have got on board and whether they're of a concern from a sanctions perspective is something that would be really, really helpful. But we've come a long way, and the speed of progress is obviously only going to accelerate.
Thank you. I think our fifth participant has just arrived. morning.
Hi, sorry, I wish I could say that I was tending to an emergency on a vessel. In fact, I think my phone was updated to iOS 26, and I think you have to reset all the alarms when that happens.
That's useful information for any of us who's about to update their phones. Thank you. Thanks, Hamish, for joining us. We will now, I suppose, probably put you on the spot a little bit, but we've just been discussing how technology might help to navigate some of the risks in the markets around sanctions, around tariffs, around kind of particular challenges. I'd be interested from your point of view as a ship owner whether you're seeing much of that.
Well, I don't see too much of it yet. You know, I think the Treasury Department in the U.S. and the EU has a separate unit that does this, put out lists of sanctioned entities. And I think it's up to the shipping company to decide whether somebody is close enough to the name on the sanctions list that they have to be treated as sanctioned or not. But I don't think there's a lot of technology there to help at the moment, and I think it would be probably quite useful.
Thank you. I suppose a broader question on that topic. Shipping has historically been perhaps slower to adopt technologies than other industries. Do we think the industry is ready for AI in this kind of context or taking up technological solutions?
I disagree with that statement. I think that was true before the COVID. I think we were lagging in many ways, but I think the COVID accelerated the technology and the digitalization of the global maritime industry. I was asked a question just a few days ago about the decarbonization trajectory and whether are we seeing a setback or are we seeing that we are moving forward. And I do believe that the global maritime industry is taking on the digitalization and believing that the technology is going to help us to decarbonize. And I do believe in 2035, 2040, we are going to see AI that is going to drive us in the way we do our business and in the way our ships trade and in the ways we can bring down the CO2 emissions.
Thank you. Thank you. Hamish, let me ask you slightly going back to a topic we discussed previously, but from a ship owner's perspective, have you seen that you've had to adjust any of your operational commercial strategy in the face of kind of the ever-changing tariffs? And is that even possible considering that it's changing daily?
It would, in fact, be easier for us in the dry bulk industry to change our operations quickly than, for instance, the container industry, which is really operating a very complex line where connections have to be made and the time has to be accurate to a few hours. You know, we have laycan windows of days with our dry bulk cargoes. And, we're typically in the spot market, so, we might not know where a ship is going to be, 60 days from now, or even 30 days from now. So we could adapt if we had to adapt. We haven't really had to adapt, because just out of sheer luck, I think, the port fees that are being proposed on Chinese vessels are only for ships of a certain class or larger, and that I believe lets through the Kamsarmaxes most of the time. But also it's for imports of things to the U.S. where there are port fees on Chinese ships, not exports. And we're typically in the business of exporting grain and coal from the U.S. We're not really bringing much, if anything, to the U.S. as dry bulk cargoes. And, as long as there is a market in the rest of the world for those dry bulk cargoes, and so far the world economy hasn't collapsed yet, I think we'll do fine. I think the container people will have a much harder problem.
And as Germany is a container country, when it comes to shipping, one of our greatest worries is how is the impact on ship financing with the USTR proposal or law? Because if you have a Chinese leasing construction in your company, it is your vessel will be judged as Chinese owned, and then the tariffs or the port fees that you will need to pay are huge, right? So you have to refinance your ship. You have to find a new model how to restructure your Chinese leasing. And that is, of course, a major problem and a major disruption for that ship-owning company that might have this model implemented. So we are not certain about the impact yet. We are just seeing the beginning of it. And that is something where we worry quite substantially. And if you look at, 70% of all container ship new builds are coming from Chinese yards. So we're talking a large scale of impact on the horizon. But in the end, it's just rerouting and taking out Chinese-built ships from strings going to the United States.
Or paying the fee. So sometimes I think it's going to be easier to pay the fee than to try to take the Chinese ship out of the string.
Yeah. And hopefully, maybe we'll get some more clarity. We were successful in lobbying the U.S. Trade Representative to reopen Annex 3 on the vehicle carriers. We haven't heard back from them yet. It's about a month to go before the fees go into effect. But like other colleagues have mentioned, imposing the fee on all farm-built vessels is unmoored from the China 301 investigation and into market manipulation. And so they do conceivably take on some legal risk. We've seen in the IEEPA tariffs that are being litigated right now, there's a possibility of damages as well. And so, it's how those come out. So we would hope that they would provide some additional clarity. Right now they're also applying to the U.S. Maritime Security Program vessel participants in that are vehicle carriers. And we would think they would have to back off on that. Otherwise, the model doesn't make sense to participate in that program where you're hauling U.S. Sea lift support and DOD cargoes. So hopefully they come back, with some additional clarity that would be helpful. And like Martin mentioned, the sale leaseback financing arrangements, that whether you're the owner or not, when you fill out the CB form 1300, is certainly, there's been various legal opinions on that, and many commentators, including World Shipping Council, have asked for some additional clarity on those points. So hopefully we do receive that, but the clock is certainly ticking, and so I think the assumption ship owners have to make right now is, as the first order, on October 14th, as written, those fees are going to come into effect unless we hear something more.
And as a legislator, if you are looking for a sign, if you've actually introduced bad legislation, which is completely unacceptable, then it is if people start paying fees or fines voluntarily. That's the sign you're looking for, that you introduce something which is completely crazy. And this is not only for the U.S. This also goes for the EU. If you look at the Fuel EU regulation, for example, to take environmental regulation into focus a little. If you're at a stage where you have a company saying, "I'd rather pay the fine because it's cheaper than complying," something is wrong with your legislation. Don't look any further. Look at your legislation and change it. That would be quite a thing.
So coming towards the end of the panel, so it's a question then is, we've talked about how, trade patterns might change, people will go to where the trade is, they might not be the US, Chinese leasing might lose out, people will have to refinance, which means that some of the other financiers might win. So, but who's winning here? I can see a situation where if trade is directed away from the US that increases competition? You know, who's going to win here and who's going to lose, or do we just not know?
You know, I read an Economist article recently, and they spoke about the U.S. tariffs and who is winning. And Economist has said that China is going to win. And if you look at the year-on-year, although the exports to U.S. has actually dropped, if memory serves me correctly, actually dropped by about 20%, but actually China exports to all the other countries have increased. And in fact, they said about with the African nations, it's about 30%. With Southeast Asia, it's about a certain percentage. And they are also setting up their production facilities in Southeast Asia. So, you know, if you look at US, it is 11% of the global trade. 89% of the trade does not involve US. But US is still a very big partner. But countries are making decisions, what works. And Chinese, with its diplomacy now and the way they are doing business, it does look, if I read the Economist article correctly, it does seem that China is going to win.
Thank you.
Well, yeah, I think your question was really about ship finance.
I think it's more general, but for example, like ship finance is, I suppose, one aspect.
Yeah, you know, I think basically the U.S. is, of course, out of ship finance for all practical purposes. There are one or two banks that lend against shipping, but nothing, you know, not in high volume. You know, the European shipping banks, the Asian shipping banks remain very strong. And are willing to lend large amounts to large shipping companies and willing to lend much less to small shipping companies. And I think that this actually might be what eventually drives some consolidation in the ship-owning business. But China is, of course, very strong in ship lending as well.
I'll just say, I think, you know, trade's going to eventually win. So it's despite the forecast, it's eventually gone up. Carolyn makes a good point. There's emerging markets in West Africa and India. But traditionally, when you look back on history, and protectionism hasn't lasted for very long. It's always a tempting thing at different points in history and different points in time. But overall, the global trade seems to prevail.
I think it's always tempting at things like this to emphasize this is a period of unprecedented uncertainty. Probably if you went back and looked at every time there's been one of these panels, it's always been said to be a time of unprecedented uncertainty. So I agree that actually you can be overly pessimistic about the way things are going to develop. I think in the sanctions space, obviously there's been a lot of talk around the potential bifurcation with the West on one side and China, India, and potentially Russia on the other side, and the dangers of that. I think increasingly there is also a danger of just increased fragmentation where the US and the EU and the UK aren't all speaking with one voice.
Thank you. I think we are basically out of time. So thank you very much to our panelists, and thank you for listening.
Thank you.